The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
Happy Leif Erikson Day to all those practicing, all you SpongeBob fans out there. It is a busy Wednesday on the Brad Sessmatt Show. I'm Jordan Hamm, filling in for the big guy. And we have two Game 5s in the MLB playoffs tonight. This has been a really good postseason, a really competitive postseason so far. I talked last week about the playing wild card games, and you can't replicate the win or go home atmosphere that playoff baseball has. We got a whole bunch of them in this series. You have the Yankees took care of the Twins pretty handily, but other than that, a whole bunch of Game 5s. Braves in St. Louis tonight, Washington, L.A. as well, and then Tampa Bay forcing a Game 5 against Houston. And it's really interesting looking at, I was reading an article about kind of the next generation of baseball players and how some of them are being featured in the postseason right now. You also have the likes of Fernando Tatis Jr., Vlad Guerrero Jr., Ronald Acuna, Ozzie Albies with Atlanta. And you look at not only the position players, those are the guys who seem to get the most love, but two pitchers in Game 5s that certainly can be the next generation of MLB players. When you have Jack Flaherty going Game 5 against St. Louis, Walker Buehler for the Dodgers. So we're going to get into more of that. We also have Justin Spears of the Arizona Daily Star joining us, talking all things U of A. Gerald Bourget of FanSided. All the overreactions from the Phoenix Suns preseason opener that looked like a different brand of basketball than what we've seen here in Phoenix the past few years. So I want to talk to him. So let's just get things going here with our rundown brought to you by Sagicor Now. Sagicor Now, protect what matters most. And when you look at these two Game 5s that are tonight and then one coming up for the AL as well, the young pitching is what jumps out to me. You have Walker Buehler, Jack Flaherty, two guys. Buehler's logged a little bit more time than Flaherty, but what a second half Jack Flaherty's had for St. Louis. At the first half of the year, it was like a 4-5 ERA, and he's been absolutely dominant, and they trust him going in the biggest game of the year for them. So really great baseball so far. We saw a great game yesterday with Tampa Bay and Houston. Tampa Bay won that one 4-1, but it got very interesting at the end of the game. And they were able to take care of business against Justin Verlander. And they've hit these aces, these Houston aces we've heard so much about, especially when Zach Greinke made his way over there. Tampa Bay has been able to be effective against them. And they utilized that opener mentality, had quite a few guys throw. Blake Snell, arguably their best pitcher, was the one closing out the game last night for them. And when you look at these two teams, Houston and Tampa Bay, I think these are the two teams in the postseason, remaining in the postseason, I should say, that if you're a Diamondbacks fan, I think the success route that you want to go, it's somewhere in between these two. You have Tampa Bay, who is the small market, continues just to find these quality guys, whether they be, on kind of smaller free agent deals or their homegrown guys. Quite a few years ago, they also had a big draft stockpile that they didn't really hit on, with the exception of Blake Snell. And then you have Houston, who is a slightly bigger market, but still certainly not the L.A., St. Louis, Chicago, New York. But they've been able to kind of build that team up by honestly tanking, but getting some high draft picks, hitting on those high draft picks, and then adding pieces, bringing in Garrett Cole, bringing in Zach Greinke, bringing in a lot of talent as well. I think that if you're looking at what the Diamondbacks, the route they want to take, if they want to be playing October and November baseball specifically, the route's going to be in between those two. They're going to have a ton of homegrown talent come up and be effective, not only in the rotation, which I feel like we've seen the most effective players so far come up on the mound, not necessarily as position players. And I think there are more veterans on the in the position player spots right now. But you're going to need to hit on those. You're going to be sometimes budgeted out on some of the high profile guys. But if you can pick your points and go get yourself Gerrit Cole and make a trade for a Zach Greinke, you know, those are the types of routes I see Mike Hazen making if they're on the verge of making the postseason in the coming years. But both have very strong farm systems, and that's something that the Diamondbacks have been able to do the past couple of years, build that up. It was a bottom third, really bottom fifth, farm system. Now it is in anywhere from the top five to top 10, and has been really effective with the way they've been able to, really build that up. But I think that they can go out and get, a difference maker, whether it be in free agency or trade. We've only really seen it in trade so far, but I think that they can go ahead and utilize that now with free agency with a little bit more financial flexibility. So postseason baseball, especially win or go home, it is very, very special, and I love watching that sort of stuff. With the Cardinals, they came off a win against the Bengals. The Bengals, I think, kind of bungled it at times. But seeing this new iteration of Kyler Murray really utilizing the run game, this is where he becomes must-see TV. He can make a ton of throws. He has made a lot of very impressive throws so far. But the things that made me stop what I was doing and focus completely solely on the game, which is a very tough thing for me to do because I'm constantly working on something, logging footage for something, on social media for work, whatever it may be. I always kind of have one eye on the TV, but there were a few of his runs where I closed the computer, I dropped the phone, and I made some audible noises where it was like, oh my God, like what the heck did he just do? Those are the types of plays that can just make him a marquee player in this league. And not only that, but they utilized David Johnson, they utilized Chase Edmonds. And I know that was a bit of a matchup that they were trying to exploit. But seeing the versatility and being able to adapt, that was something that was promising. Yes, again, it's the Bengals. Right now they're targeted to be the number one, kind of 1-3 pick, like one of the worst teams in the league. It took them to the last seconds to win that game. But now you're playing a Falcons team that there's a lot of disarray. And I think that, Cliff Kingsbury, Kyler Murray, this is their strength going up against a struggling defense. Now they just need to put pedal to the metal. The defense is still a work in progress and still one more week until Patrick Peterson comes back. I'm interested to see the adjustments that happen once Patrick Peterson is there. Now moving Byron Murphy, where does he go in the secondary? Is he now becoming the slot guy, which would have been his strength from the get-go? Is that all of a sudden, does that mean the tight ends all of a sudden aren't exactly murdering the Cardinals? Probably still a little bit effective, but how much does that change? We still have one more game before we can really see that. But you look at Falcons, Cardinals, on paper, it's probably like, oh, yeah, Falcons don't, like, they're going to take care of it. I could see the Cardinals squeaking this one out. Can you imagine that? Getting that first home win against a Falcons team that has Matt Ryan, Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley, a prominent pass game. I just feel like on both sides, it's just going to be throw. Like they're going to combine for like 1,000 passing yards on this one. So going to be interesting to watch. I know Eric's going to be over at that game. I have ASU duties this week. And we're going to talk to ASU's rival, talk some U of A with Justin Spears, Arizona Daily Star, ESPN Tucson. He is a busy, busy man. That's coming up next on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Welcome back to the Brad Sesmatt Show. Jordan Hamm here, hosting. We have Devin Henry on the other side of the glass, making sure we look and sound good. Always appreciate the Swiss Army knife of Sports 360 AZ helping us out. And we are now joined by one of the busiest men in Tucson, Justin Spears. He works for the Arizona Daily Star, also ESPN Tucson, the Sports Exchange, every afternoon in Tucson. Justin, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Jordan, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate coming on.
So we're going to get to U of A football here in a second, but with basketball right around the corner, Media Day was yesterday. Nico Mannion and Josh Green were the two player reps for U of A. The Wildcats picked fourth for the preseason poll. Just what do you make of what the basketball team is going to look like this year?
You know, this team is going to be very interesting because there's so much turnover. You know, you look at this roster, and it is completely different compared to last year, and that's actually for the better. You know, last year's team finished ninth in the conference. It was a down year, but then you look at, you know, the newcomers that they have coming in. Most notably, as you guys know, up in Phoenix, Nico Mannion, that point guard, you know, five-star guy who's a McDonald's All-American, and then Josh Green, another five-star player who played in the Phoenix area, Hillcrest Prep, and he's originally from Australia. So those two guys, you know, Arizona is headlined by those two freshmen right there, and they represented U of A at Pac-12 Media Day, like you just mentioned. You know, but then you look at, you know the other newcomers. Christian Coloco is an interesting guy because, you know, he's a long, raw guy. He's new to basketball. He's a Cameroon native. And for those wondering, Cameroon is where Joel Embiid is from. So basketball is growing in Cameroon, and Christian Coloco came over to Los Angeles in high school. So he's still relatively new to basketball, but Sean Miller said that Christian Coloco is better than we thought. And so, you know, he was a guy that, you know, he's a seven-footer, and he's kind of light. You know, his weight isn't ideal, but, you know, from what we're hearing from Sean Miller and some of these other guys, you know, Christian Coloco, you know, might get some playing time this year. Then another, you know, thing you got to look at are the, you know, the veterans, the returning guys. How can Ira Lee and Dylan Smith carve out an important role? You know, Ira Lee last year was really kind of like a pit bull for Arizona. He was getting every single rebound. You know, he was, you know, dominating the glass and getting a lot of putbacks. And I think, you know, that's the kind of role that he can have this year, almost like a Dennis Rodman, an energetic guy that's just going to do all the dirty work. So, you know, this team is going to be pretty interesting. Now, fourth in the Pac-12, I might have would have, you know, selected Arizona higher over a team like Colorado. I know McKinley Wright is going to be pretty good at that point guard spot, and a lot of people are high on Tyler Bay as an NBA prospect. But I think Arizona is better than Colorado. Now, Oregon and Washington, that's to be determined because both those teams are very talented as well.
Yeah, I think when you look at the teams that finished 2 through 5 last year, I think they're going to be kicking themselves because I think it was a missed opportunity to really take advantage of a down year for U of A because they are coming back strong with a lot of those freshmen coming in. On the football side, obviously U of A gets a big win on the road at Colorado. Something about Colorado and Khalil Tate. What was your biggest takeaway just from that win for the Wildcats on Saturday?
We're finally seeing the complete version of Khalil Tate. You know, in 2017, when Arizona went up to Colorado, we saw Khalil Tate the athlete, you know, a guy that ran for 327 yards, which was a record by a quarterback in a single game in college football history. So we saw Khalil Tate the athlete then. This past Saturday against Colorado, you know, Khalil Tate was awesome, especially in the second half. You know, he threw an interception at some point in the second quarter. And, you know, normally the Khalil Tate that we all knew would have tapped out. He would have threw in the white towel and the game would have been over. But Khalil Tate kept his head up. And after that interception, he finished like 24 of 28 passing. And, you know, he was so efficient. He was finding a lot of wide receivers. And he was a complete general. My colleague, Michael Levin, and I, you know, we host a podcast called the Wildcast Podcast. And we talked about this earlier last week. You know, Khalil Tate a couple years ago, if we're mixing sports metaphors here, Khalil Tate was almost like a Russell Westbrook. You know, just an athletic freak point guard, but he was going to make sure that he got hit. The quarterback that we saw this past Saturday was almost like a Chris Paul, a guy that's, of course, you know, going to get it done with his feet if he needs to, but is going to distribute the ball and be a complete floor general. We saw that Khalil Tate last Saturday against Colorado, and it should be interesting to see how Khalil Tate performs moving forward.
With last year, I know that he had some injuries, so that kind of limited him in the run game. But do you feel like Kevin Sumlin, Noel Mazzone have kind of opened up the playbook a little bit, made the necessary adjustments really to make Khalil Tate thrive? Because it felt like last year it was kind of a square peg round hole situation, but now all of a sudden it looks like Khalil's beating Texas Tech with his legs, beating Colorado with his arm, mix of both with some other games.
Yeah, and the offense is pretty interesting because we're so used to seeing Arizona playing up-tempo just because of the personnel that they have. But you go back to that Texas Tech game, and Jordan, you were there. I think the most important part of that game was putting together a 99-yard drive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 13-play, 99-yard drive, and they didn't attempt a single pass during that drive. It was all run. So Arizona, you know, they got layers to their offense, and the running backs help out a lot. And the thing about the running backs, though, yeah, they have J.J. Taylor and Gary Brightwell. They're great backs. But then you look at Michael Wiley, who's a true freshman out of Texas, Bam Smith, who's a sophomore out of Texas. Those running backs are lethal in the passing game. So it's not like Khalil Tate is just relying on wide receivers. He's got running backs that can get it done in the passing game. And then at the wide receiver spot, they have so many options. You know, last year it was just Shaun Brown, Sean Poindexter, Tony Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
You rinse, wash, repeat. Any of those three, those are the guys that Khalil Tate is throwing to. Now Khalil Tate has Jamari Joyner, Tavian Cunningham, Brian Castile, Drew Dixon, you know, Stanley Berryhill. You know, the list grows at the wide receiver spot for Arizona. So I think it's just a matter of Arizona, they can change their tempo, and Khalil Tate has more weapons to throw to.
Talking to Justin Spears on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Now, with the defense, the last time you were on, it was after the Hawaii loss. The defense looked pretty darn bad. Where have you seen them make improvements? What are you wanting to see more of from that side of the football?
Yeah, the biggest improvement is they finally got the best 11 guys on the field. That's something that Kevin Sumlin has been harping on ever since that Hawaii loss. And I think the big thing about Arizona and their defense and their identity right now is that linebacker spot. You know, Colin Schooler was the best defender going into this season. I still think he is, but Anthony Tandy at that linebacker spot, Tony Fields at that linebacker spot, it just seems like, although while Colin Schooler is leading the team in tackles, it just seems like Tony Fields and Anthony Tandy, one of those guys is going to have a special game for Arizona. They alternate. One game it's Pandy, one game it's Fields. Most recently it was Tony Fields. He was all over the field. And that helped out with their pass rush. Pandy is able to get to the quarterback. Tony Fields is also able to get to the quarterback. And they're getting these quarterbacks rattled. You know, it doesn't really show on paper. I'm not sure exactly what their sack total is, but it's not crazy high. But what they're doing is they're getting these pocket passers, these quarterbacks that do damage in the pocket, they're rattling them up a little bit, and they're getting them outside of the pocket so they can make them uncomfortable. And that's really been a big difference in the back end because Jace Whitaker has been almost like a center fielder in that secondary. And I've seen nothing but love for him on Twitter, you know, for national media. I saw one tweet that said, you know, some NFL scouts, while Jace Whitaker doesn't have the ideal size, they're looking at him to play possibly a nickelback. And when I say center fielder, he's been kind of, you know, molding into that, you know, the kind of that inside quarterback or that safety. So he's been very impressive. And then Christian Young has also stepped up ever since the NAU game. It's just all the pieces are starting to fit for Arizona's defense, and they're starting to get somewhat of an identity. And I didn't even talk about the defensive line. You know, last year they didn't have this much depth. And now they have about eight guys that are rotating on that defensive line. They didn't have that last year, even with P.J. Johnson and Derek Bowles. So they got more depth. There's fresh bodies. And the strength and conditioning program has been pretty good down in Tucson. So in the fourth quarter, you know, they're locked down. Over the last three games, Arizona's outscored their opponents 29-3. You know, you only give up in the fourth quarter. If you only give up 3 points in the fourth quarter over the last three games, something's working well, and Arizona's defense is definitely performing well.
Yeah, pretty darn impressive there. So you have a good Washington team coming into Tucson, coming off a loss to Stanford. Just what do you think the key to the game is for this one?
Oh, man. this is going to be tough for Arizona. This is going to be their toughest opponent that they play all season long. And, yeah, I'm kind of worried for Arizona because I look back at Washington when they lost to Cal. And the next game, they play BYU at BYU, and they just came in and totally manhandled BYU. So Washington recently just lost to Stanford. So could that happen down in Tucson? I can totally see that happening. But I think, you know, the key for Arizona is, you know, Khalil Tate, you know, just continue to do what you're doing. You know, you're not doing too much. The offense is really working well with him as the quarterback, and now that he is more mature, he's more poised, the offense just has a flow to it. And also, get to Jacob Eason. You know, it's going to be hard because Washington's offensive line is pretty good, you know, but if they can get to Jacob Eason and if they can rattle him up a little bit, I think Arizona's going to hang tough. Now, do I think Arizona's going to win? No. But I think Arizona will compete in this game, and it's going to be a fun one down here in Tucson.
Now, I see quite a few winnable games here for U of A over the next month, but then they end the year with three teams currently ranked. They're hosting Utah, at Oregon, and then at Arizona State. Where does this team need to be, you know, a month from now to make sure that they're, you know, battle ready for that stretch to end the year?
A win against Washington would certainly help because, you know, at that point you're 5-1, and you're going into, and then you're going into a big game against USC, which is very winnable. So if you win these next two games, you're 6-1. You're already bowl eligible, and that's pretty good. But you know, I think once they get, you know, to the last, you know, three games of the season, I would say they're going to lose to Oregon. And then I think that they have a strong possibility of beating ASU at ASU, even though it's going to be pretty tough. But I would say at that point in the season, you know, just get bowl eligible. If you're bowl eligible by that stretch, then you're in pretty good shape if you're Arizona.
Justin Spears, appreciate you, buddy. You do great work. And thanks for the time and the insight on U of A basketball and football.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jordan.
That is Justin Spears, Arizona Daily Star, ESPN Tucson. Guy is everywhere. Not only covering U of A, we went U of A heavy this time, but he also does a great job on the prep side and the recruiting side in Tucson and Southern Arizona as well. Always appreciate him jumping on. Coming up next, we have Gerald Bourguet of FanSided, another guy who just logs so much time covering the Suns. We're going to talk about that preseason opener they had last night and what overreactions can we make from that. That's coming up next on the Brad Sussman Show. Appreciate Justin Spears jumping on with us last segment to talk U of A football and basketball now as the NBA season is approaching. Wanted to get Gerald Bourguet on, editor and writer for FanSided NBA. Gerald, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So last night, preseason opener for the Suns. Obviously, you got to take these games with a grain of salt. It's the preseason. It's also one game, but there will be plenty of overreactions here from this game. What's your biggest overreaction from this first showing, from this iteration of the Suns?
I mean, the Suns aren't going to win the 2020 NBA championship. I get all the optimism because last night was a breath of fresh air. Like, it was amazing to see the Suns had an actual NBA point guard, and the Suns had actual NBA rotation players, and the Suns had a rookie in Ty Jerome and Cam Johnson, too, who looked like they belonged out on the court. But at the same time, you know, it's, you know, they're playing a Timberwolves team that's probably going to be around their area if the Suns even reach their highest goal this season in terms of wins. So, you know, and it's preseason, and, you know, we saw the Suns thrive in their regular season opener last year against the Dallas Mavericks,
and things fell apart pretty quickly. So I'm definitely, you know, encouraged by what I saw last night, but, you know, it's going to take a lot more to win over the fan base and to prove to people, you know, this Suns team really is different from the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
When you look at this backcourt now, Ricky Rubio and Devin Booker, the first time Devin Booker's had a true point guard to work with, just what do you expect? How do you think that backcourt's going to work together, and how will that help Devin Booker progress?
I mean, on the offensive end, it's pretty clear, like, he will be able to work off the ball a little bit more. You look at his three-point shooting numbers last year, he shot a career-worst, like, 32% from three. And that's because most of his attempts were on pull-up threes off the dribble. You know, coming out of college, he was pegged as like a spot-up shooter, off-ball movement kind of guy, like a poor man's Klay Thompson in that way. So having Rubio to set him up and feed him easy looks will allow him to get back to that, because he did post a respectable percentage from three on catch-and-shoot looks last year. So that's really going to help. It's going to take the pressure off him to do everything, to both score and play make. And then on the defensive end, like, Rubio is a ball hawk. He's a competitor defensively, and it didn't show as much with Utah last year because everyone else on their team was so good defensively, but it already kind of stuck out last night, and that's one area where Booker has struggled to this point in his career and something that he definitely needs to improve. So Rubio really, I mean, he's slightly overpaid, but his salary is like average for an NBA point guard, and he's really going to help in just the fact that he's a huge upgrade from Isaiah Cannon and 2 second-round rookies, which is what they had last year.
Year two for DeAndre Ayton. Just what steps do you want to see him make in his second year in the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, everyone talks about the three-point shooting, and I think that's going to be great. It seems like Monty Williams is going to allow him to let it fly this year. And he's been working on that aspect of his game, so I don't think it's something, you know, you look at the NBA guys are jacking up threes now more and more, but it is something that he has worked on diligently, so if he's able to shoot it efficiently, you know, why not? The most important thing for me, though, is his ability to defend the rim better. Last year he was one of the worst defenders in terms of rim protection around the basket, and he has to be better off the ball with his help defense. He's pretty good, actually, on the perimeter, switching on the ball handlers. I think a lot of guys were surprised last year getting him on a switch in screen and roll situations, how well he was able to stick with them and force contested shots. There were those two games where he matched up with LeBron James and Giannis last year for the whole game and actually held his own. But he's got to get better at the rim protection stuff, at communicating defensively, and at becoming the anchor that this team is going to need him to be if it wants to be able to keep him on the floor in playoff scenarios down the road.
Talking to Gerald Bourguet, editor-writer for Fansided NBA. Over the offseason, I thought you made a really good point that the Suns overall improved, but their asset management was pretty poor to get to the process of where they are currently. With this improvement, where do you expect to see the most improvement with this team?
You know, just in, it sounds sad to say this because they're an NBA team and that's what you would expect from any NBA team, but just in their ability to compete on a night-in, night-out basis. You look at the team from last year, it had a lot of guys who were still trying to find themselves in the NBA, even the guys who had been in the league for a few years, like Rashawn Holmes. Their mentors over the last few years have mostly been locker room guys only, like guys that can't actually contribute to winning on the court. And that makes it hard for young players to grow, and it makes it hard for the team to compete when they've either got a bunch of over-the-hill veterans or young guys who are trying to learn from them. And it makes it difficult, that mix. This year, they have established NBA players who have been around for a while, but are also not, you know, dad bod Jared Dudley anymore. So that's going to be helpful. And I think you look at last year's team, there were just nights when you watched them and you could tell the game was over by the second quarter. Like, NBA games are long games, but when you're down 20 in the second quarter, like, there's no reason for fans to keep watching the game. I think that's going to change this season. I think Igor Kokoskov kind of lost his locker room a little bit on some nights. The body language was just poor. I think this year that's not going to be the same thing.
The Suns will still take their licks. The West is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just being able to compete on a night-in, night-out basis is going to be a huge difference from last year.
You already mentioned Ty Jerome had a strong showing last night. Eli Okobo also in there. How do you see the backup point guard spot kind of shaking out as the regular season's right around the corner?
Yeah, I mean, I think behind Rubio, Jerome has the best case for earning that spot full-time. I think it's going to be interesting to see when roster cuts come how they go about choosing between Eli Okobo and Javon Carter. Carter brings a really good defensive mindset to the team off the bench. He was actually shooting corner threes, and he's been working on that element of his game too. So if he's able to do that, that really strengthens his case. But I do think it's too early to give up on Okobo as well. He showed really nice flashes last night, and they've been able to play him at the two a little bit more instead of trying to pigeonhole him into a point guard spot. So it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. But right now, Jerome looks like the steadiest option. He was very good last night. He was making a lot of smart cuts. They actually missed him on quite a few cuts where he could have had easy looks. He was facilitating, running the NBA offense, and just looked like he belonged. So I would give the nod to Jerome, and then it'll be interesting to see whether Okobo and Carter can kind of carve out minutes for themselves somewhere in there.
What's the biggest storyline you're looking at with this team in the early 2019-2020 season?
The biggest storyline for me is honestly being able to prove that Devin Booker is not an empty stats kind of player, you know, a good stats, bad team kind of guy. Like, people who, like us, who have been forced to watch the Suns on a nightly basis for the last few years, we know that Devin Booker is actually good, that he impacts winning, and that this team would somehow be even more miserable without him.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people on the outside just see his big, you know, box score numbers and see the team losing by 15 to 20 points and just assume that he doesn't actually impact winning. I think if you look at the teammates that he's had around him over the last few seasons, you know, this season he's entering the year with his 69th different teammate. He's entering his fifth season with his fifth different head coach, his second different GM. Like, he's had zero stability around him. And I feel like this is finally the year when, even if the Suns only improve to like 30 wins or something like that, that's still an 11-game win improvement from last year. And I think if you put actual NBA players around him, you will see that he'll get the chance to shine and hopefully improve some of those flaws in his game, like defense and the turnovers, kind of tidy those areas up to help contribute to winning more. But I'm really excited to see him with his first legitimate NBA team, because he hasn't really had one since he's been in the NBA.
Gerald, we appreciate the time and the insight. Thanks for it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That is Gerald Bourguet, editor-writer for FanSided NBA and The Step Back. His Twitter is at Gerald Bourguet. And like I said, he just logs a ton of time covering the Phoenix Suns, does a great job doing that. Coming up next, going to talk ASU Utah. We saw the time of that game and the network it's on, and there was a lot of confusion with that. There might be a bit of an explanation. That's coming up next on the Brad Sessmann Show. Welcome back to the Brad Sessmann Show. Thanks to Justin Spears and Gerald Bourguet both for joining us, talking some U of A, also Phoenix Suns. Both of those guys, give them a follow on Twitter. They work really hard and are really everywhere in their coverage. Wanted to look ahead. You know, obviously ASU playing Washington State at home, 12:30 kick, but they have a big game on the road on October 19th. Arizona State at Utah. What should be a matchup, should things go according to plan this weekend, two one-loss teams battling for the Pac-12 South and have huge implications on what could be the Pac-12 championship game and the representation for the South Division. John Wilner of the Mercury News does a great job with his Pac-12 Hotline newsletter, and he had some insight on what it's like choosing the games for that week between ESPN, Pac-12 Network, you know, Fox, if they're available, and that sort of thing. And I think a lot of people were scratching their heads seeing that huge matchup, and it was going to be at 3 o'clock on the Pac-12 Network. Now, you might think, as Wilner points out, it might be better served for the fans and really the national audience to have it on the ESPN family of networks, maybe at a later time, more eyeballs, that sort of thing. So he kind of broke it down for us, the readers. And what he said was ESPN, Pac-12 Network, they kind of do the game selections almost in a draft format. And ESPN gets first crack. That weekend is Oregon-Washington. So makes sense that they would be the top game, two of the more recognizable brands. Even though Washington is struggling, Oregon has lost or dropped a game or two maybe they shouldn't have. Two big brands in the Pac-12 getting on ESPN/ABC. So then Pac-12 Network has that next choice. And among the games, it was ASU, Utah, Oregon State, Cal, Arizona, USC, Colorado, Washington State. Now, what has happened sometimes in the past is the Pac-12 will not necessarily take the best game, but take a pretty good game to still get some eyeballs on the network, but also make sure that ESPN and, again, this national audience is looking into it. Turns out they opted to take ASU Utah, and then, you know, kind of the draft continues that way. That means that as the ratings are better, as Wilner puts it, the better sponsorships, the better advertising sales, the better sponsorship and advertising sales, the more revenue. And the more revenue for the networks means more cash for the schools. The networks send approximately $2.75 million to each campus annually. So I think that the conference, the network, was looking at this as the big opportunity, get some big viewership, but it may not coincide with what's best for the conference, especially if, let's say, something crazy happens. One of these teams runs the table. It's a one-loss team in the Pac-12. Arguably, their best win would be in front of an audience that Wilner points out is about the a fifth of the size of what it would be on ESPN2 or ESPNU. So just the dynamics of that is just always very interesting of how that works. I think this was a great opportunity to get two pretty darn good teams, some really good viewership in a national opportunity. But I also understand the conferences side and the network side, because usually it is kind of some of the lower tier games are on at that time. So at what point is it where the conference and the network says, hey, we need to get ours. And I think that this is one of the better opportunities to go ahead and do that, especially when you have Oregon and Washington going head to head. So the conference is still represented. But the dynamics of that is very interesting. John Wilner does a great job covering the Pac-12 and kind of the ins and outs and the, you know, the off the field stuff like this. So an interesting dynamic. I encourage you all to go check that out. Again, it's the Mercury News is what he works for and has the Pac-12 hotline newsletter that he puts out really consistently and does a great job. So, again, special thanks to Justin Spears talking U of A basketball, U of A football. Special thanks to Gerald Bourget helping us preview the Suns a little bit for this upcoming season. And special thanks to Devin Henry, the Swiss Army knife of Sports 360 AZ, for making sure we look and sound good. I'm Jordan Hamm. Have a great day.